This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After writing several books on the civil rights movement, David Garrow has written a history of the reproductive rights movement. Garrow is best known for his Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King called Bearing the Cross. His new book, Liberty and Sexuality, is about the right to sexual privacy and the battles surrounding the legalization of contraception and abortion. Garrow's history begins with Connecticut's anti-contraception statute, which was passed in 1879. Contraception was outlawed in Connecticut until 1965, when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned that law and guaranteed the right to use birth control. The Connecticut statute forbade obscene literature and any materials concerning sex or reproduction. It outlawed the use of any drug, medicine, article, or instrument for the purpose of preventing conception. You may be surprised to hear who pushed through that bill. It was P.T. Barnum of circus fame, who then chaired the Connecticut Joint Committee on Temperance.
Barnum, in addition to his circus work, was quite active in Connecticut state politics, served 3 terms in the state legislature, was mayor of Bridgeport for several years, and was really sort of the Connecticut representative of Anthony Comstock's anti-obscenity crusade. A number of other states, New York and Massachusetts, in those years passed very similar statutes, but only the Connecticut one expressly outlawed even the use of birth control.
What was the argument against birth control?
Once the battle was really joined in Connecticut in the early 1920s, when Katharine Hepburn Sr., the mother of the well-known actress, first really launched what became Connecticut Planned Parenthood, the opposition forces that Mrs. Hepburn and the other early women's rights activists in Connecticut were up against was primarily the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. By the 1920s and 30s, Connecticut had a significant Catholic population, Irish, Italian, Lithuanian immigrant communities, and the church hierarchy in the state really adopted the anti-birth control law as a political symbol of the power of the Catholic Church and of the church's traditional position, which, you know, has continued to the present day, that any use of quote-unquote artificial means of preventing conception is a moral sin. And what's very clear in the Connecticut struggle is the questions of economic class that were so dramatically present there. Because even though any use or counseling of birth control was illegal all those years in Connecticut, many women who could afford private physicians were, of course, able to get diaphragm fittings and other particular advice. But what was really prevented by the old Barnum law was any public establishment of birth control clinics for working class or poor women who, in terms of Connecticut's working class immigrant populations, tended to be very disproportionately Roman Catholic. And so from 1939-1940 on for a quarter century until the Griswold decision in 1965, clinics continued to be prohibited by the criminal law in Connecticut.
Yeah, the Barnum law outlawing contraception stayed on the books until 1965 when it was overturned by the Supreme Court. What was the case that overturned that law?
The case that eventually overturned the old 1879 law was called Griswold versus Connecticut, named after one of the two criminal defendants who were appealing their convictions, Estelle Griswold, who had become head of Connecticut Planned Parenthood in the 1950s, and who was a marvelously energetic character. She indeed had put together a previous case that the U.S. Supreme Court in 1961 had turned aside by a one-vote margin on the grounds that there wasn't any evidence that anybody was in the present day being arrested under the law. even though unbeknownst to the justices, during the very months that the case was in the Supreme Court, wholesalers of condoms, for example, were indeed being arrested and convicted in Connecticut. Right after the that 1961 duck by the Supreme Court, Estelle Griswold said, "Well, if the court has claimed that the law isn't going to be enforced, we'll simply open clinics again." And that is what she did in November of 1961 in New Haven. And much to her great pleasure, she was extremely happy when the two New Haven police detectives arrived. Much to her happiness, she and a colleague, Dr. Lee Buxton from Yale Medical School, were indeed arrested and convicted for counseling women concerning birth control in violation of the old Barnum Law.
Why were they happy? They wanted it. Do a test case and try to overturn the law?
After almost 40 years of, not getting anywhere with the Connecticut State Legislature, they knew very well that they needed actual criminal convictions in order to, really force the courts to face the basic constitutional question of did women and did, medical personnel have a fundamental right to practice and advise on birth control if that was what the women desired.
The Supreme Court overturned the Barnum Law, which made contraception illegal. The Supreme Court overturned that law on the grounds that it violated the right to privacy. What was the Supreme Court's reasoning?
The court's primary reasoning in the Griswold decision was that the entire Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution, taken as a whole, inescapably protect fundamental intimate privacy within a family and marriage context, even though, the word privacy by itself doesn't appear in any of the individual amendments. In addition, both the Ninth Amendment and really more importantly, the 14th Amendment in its protection of fundamental individual liberty also were very explicitly cited by the Griswold justices in saying that a law as intrusive to private family reproductive decision making as the outlawing of contraception, that fundamental constitutional values were very deeply and immediately infringed upon by criminalizing birth control.
When the Supreme Court overturned the Barnum Law that made contraception illegal in Connecticut, did that help pave the way for Roe v. Wade?
Yes, precisely. Prior to the Griswold Supreme Court decision in 1965, really no one in this country up until that time had really ever articulated abortion in terms of being a right. And it was how the Griswold decision spoke of birth control in the context of being a fundamental right that really intellectually and doctrinally opened the way for young lawyers to quite quickly realize that if a woman's decision with regard to birth control was a fundamental constitutional right, that ergo the argument could also be made that abortion in the context of an unwanted pregnancy could also potentially be viewed as a fundamental constitutional right.
And did Roe v. Wade talk about the right to privacy, the constitutional right to privacy?
Yes, Roe is quite directly based on Griswold, on the right to privacy, and on the very extensive development of Griswold in the abortion context that had taken place in a large number of state and lower federal courts in the years immediately preceding Roe v. Wade. I think one very crucial part of Roe's history that many people nowadays unfortunately aren't familiar with or don't remember is how much courtroom and legislative battling there was over abortion in the 6 or 7 years preceding Roe. Almost every state in America had legislative battles over abortion liberalization. And by 1971, 1972, when Roe v. Wade got to the U.S. Supreme Court, there were very similar abortion rights constitutional cases pending or already on their way up in state or federal courts in 25 to 30 of our 50 states.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Garrow. His new book, Liberty and Sexuality, is a history of the legal battles over the right to contraception and abortion. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with David Garrow, author of Liberty and Sexuality, The Right to Privacy and the Making of Roe v. Wade. He's also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of Martin Luther King, Bearing the Cross. In the past few years, there have been a lot of challenges to the right to abortion, and there have been new restrictions on abortion that have been found to be legal by the Supreme Court, restrictions put on by individual states. How strong do you think a woman's right to abortion is right now?
Roe is now completely assured for all time.
Why do you say that?
What the Supreme Court said in Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the 1992 decision in a case out of Pennsylvania, in that decision where, you know, much to some people's surprise, the court by a 5-4 margin upheld the core essence of Roe v. Wade, the way in which Justices O'Connor and Kennedy and Souter, the three crucial members of the Casey court, what they said there in a very powerful, really quite dramatically important opinion was that Roe v. Wade is not simply about abortion. It's also about the institutional authority and stature of the Supreme Court. It's about the dependability of American law and constitutional decisions and Americans' ability to rely upon the court to stand back from the political process. And it was especially dramatic because how those three justices, O'Connor, Kennedy, and Souter, were Reagan-Bush appointees, appointees who ostensibly had been chosen because they would supposedly vote to discard Roe v. Wade.
And they thought that if they backed down on Roe, it would mean that the American public couldn't trust the Supreme Court to uphold its own decisions?
Yes, very much. And the way in which they all three put their names on the one opinion, which is a device, a gesture that is very rare in court history, the last time it was done in that way was back in the late 1950s in Cooper v. Aaron, a case out of Little Rock, where the court, in very similar language to Casey, indicated that Brown v. Board of Education was untouchable. And I think post-Casey that any future nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court to be a credible candidate for confirmation by the U.S. Senate is going to have to indicate support for that O'Connor, Kennedy, Souter position in Casey, just as a nominee has to indicate that she or he supports Griswold and supports Brown v. Board of Ed. What Casey represents is really the final endorsement of Roe v. Wade as something that's not going to change.
The latest Supreme Court decision relating to abortion, and this came down just a few days ago, is that RICO, the federal anti-racketeering law, could be used against anti-abortion activists who conspired to block clinics or to intimidate providers and patients. So how can that change things? How do you expect that will be used?
The RICO decision is first and foremost, particularly because it was unanimous and written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, is a very powerful symbolic indication of how violent and extremist anti-abortion groups are now not only on the defensive, but they're very much in retreat. What I think we're presently seeing is a phase that, in a way, reminds me historically of what we saw in the late 1960s in the South in the civil rights context. A very disproportionate amount of segregationist violence, church burnings, shootings, really came after the 1964 and 1965 civil rights and voting rights acts were in place, when Ku Klux Klan type violent segregationists essentially realized they had lost. And I think that's where we essentially are now on abortion. Roe v. Wade will continue to exist for all time, and even the Randall Terrys of the world have to face that. And there may, for some number of years, continue to be acts of violence against clinics, but the constitutional stature of Roe v. Wade will be with us forever.
You're confident that the Supreme Court will not renege on Roe v. Wade, that the Supreme Court is not going to turn around and make abortion illegal. On the other hand, what a lot of people who work at abortion clinics now are saying is that legally the right is there, but there aren't doctors willing to perform abortions anymore because of the harassment that doctors who do abortions have been subjected to lately. So do you think that the Supreme Court decision of a few days ago might help change that? What do you see in the future there?
Yes. The basic question for the future is not the constitutional status of abortion, because Roe v. Wade is going to be with us, is guaranteed for all time. The future question on abortion really has to do with access to clinics and with the medical community's interest in providing abortion services. In too many states, some like North Dakota and Mississippi are the most dramatic examples, there are only one or two clinics that offer abortion services in the entire state. Some of that is due to doctors' disinterest in abortion because of the harassment they've received from Operation Rescue. And I think that the biggest challenge for pro-choice forces these next few years is not going to be in the courts, because most of that battle is now over. The real pro-choice effort in these next few years is going to be towards guaranteeing that medical professionals are going to follow through on and provide the sorts of services that Roe v. Wade and the RICO decision give constitutional Supreme Court protection to.
Last year, the Supreme Court upheld state restrictions on the right to abortions, restrictions that require, for instance, young people to get parental permission before getting an abortion, or restrictions that require waiting periods before you can get an abortion. Do you think that those restrictions will be challenged again, or do you think that they're going to stand forever?
I think it's inescapable that both the 24-hour waiting period restriction and some of the limitations on teenagers' access to abortion will indeed be challenged further once some of these state statutes, such as Pennsylvania's and Mississippi's, do take effect and evidence develops concerning what their real-life effects on women are.
How would they be challenged, though, because the Supreme Court already upheld restrictions?
The court upheld those restrictions only in a facial context where there were initial declaratory challenges to those provisions. And particularly Justices O'Connor and Souter have signaled very explicitly 9 or 10 months ago that when these questions come back to the court with a full record of factual evidence of, you know, what impact do waiting periods, for example, have on women's access to abortion, that the justices will look again at the question, to quote the appropriate language from Planned Parenthood v. Casey of whether something like a 24-hour waiting period is an undue burden or a substantial obstacle to women's fundamental right to choose. And so it indeed is quite possible that the Supreme Court some years from now will indeed strike down on a full record the sorts of limitations that in the Pennsylvania case they declined to strike down at the get-go.
Looking at it historically, do you think that the more militant of the anti-abortion activists connect to any people in the past who had opposed birth control earlier in the history of of this story? Or do you think that, it's a relatively new phenomenon?
No, I think that the basic animus towards sexuality that we see in many of the anti-abortion activists connects very directly to the attitudes that we can see historically back in the opposition to birth control in the years preceding the Griswold victory. I think what we have here is first and foremost a discomfort with acknowledging how important a role sexuality has in human life. This is not simply an animus towards women or people who are focused on the human fetus. Underlying all of this, stretching all the way back to the early part of this century, across the abortion and birth control debates, is a very deep-seated discomfort with sexuality and with open expressions of sexuality. And I think that that same discomfort or animus is also quite visible in an awful lot of the opposition towards gay Americans and acknowledging their legal status.
David Garrow is the author of Liberty and Sexuality, The Right to Privacy and the Making of Roe v. Wade. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.